And welcome to another conversation, candid conversation. Today we're talking with Stephen Clegg from Winsby. And I'd like to take a different approach today. I'd like this to be a bit of a commercial for Winsby, for Steve to explain to us what he does and how it will help you as people in the capital goods industry, whether you're selling equipment, renting equipment, new, used, parts, service, services, whatever. Because he's got incredible insight, incredible experience, and great tools. So with that, Stephen, good to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ron.
This might be interesting because I want you to brag about what you do. And you're a pretty humble man to begin with.
I think a lot of this is just through the unfortunate experiences of suffering through a lot of failure or lack of understanding than not anticipating the results.
Yeah, what I call scars.
Yeah. So what we do is
when did you start Winsby? Well, what caused you to start this?
I started because Sears Roebuck had given me their self-furnished install business, and that we had built it up pretty rapidly from nothing after they had closed it down, and then they wanted it back. So I found myself coming to Chicago and wrestling with a bear that was much larger than I was in an environment that, you know, ultimately was not going to turn out well. As I was doing this, I had been buying companies consistently for a good, 15 years. But I would buy companies based upon technology, where there's a technology out there, continuous cast for steel or aluminum or just a consolidation and operation of even a bottling plant. And so introducing that technology, you could change the paradigm in an industry and assure yourself that if you were going to try and build a business, there's a market to do it with a technology that gave you a significant advantage. So that had always been, kind of the basis. And over time, I had way back.
Let me interrupt there. So what you were identifying was technologies that made a difference in market capture or market share. Is that a fair?
Yes.
Okay. And those technologies, everybody had access to them, correct?
Everyone had access.
So this isn't a question of invention. Somebody had already created the tools, but you identified the tools earlier than other people.
Well, like the continuous cast for steel was 1954, developed here in the United States, and nobody used it. Except eventually it got used by the Japanese and the French in their big steel mills, but it wasn't applied. The idea was that you could go and melt metal, pour it, and form it, and
continuously
in line, not doing it one step at a time. So the technology was there, and things have kind of creeped to where there were mini mills, and those mini mills were ingot practice, but one line, but still applying a lot of the old technology, not the ladle technology which was needed.
And Nucor, I think, was the first American company to go with continuous rolled steel, correct?
With rolled steel, but they couldn't do it. It started out, all of it was originally scrap dealers and
right.
Because they're rolling bar and rebar, the bottom end of the market, and the big steel guys couldn't do it cheaply. So they're willing to give up those markets. But as I told people, this is an entry. You got to control the door. If you can't control the door, you'll eventually be eaten up by, the technological advancement of of what actually occurred.
So with Sears, you took on a division that Sears had, used technology that was available to Sears, but that they hadn't seen, and made it successful to the point that they came back to you and said, wait a second, we'd like to have that back.
Yes, and did a number of things that I won't bother everybody with the boring details, but they did whatever they could to undermine what we're doing.
Sure, and then that you've replicated, you've duplicated that in other instances and other applications, correct?
We applied the same technology to Koch Enterprises, where it was an antiquated bottler down in Fort Worth and built Koch Enterprises, which became the largest bottler. And the steel company that I started by buying a bolt operation down in Birmingham ended up with about 25% of the rebar market in North America. So
you're not the inventor. You're the person that looks out there, sees the tools, the technology, and you implement it. You innovate with it, correct?
Yes.
So a common denominator then is that the market that you're serving thinks it knows everything it needs to know.
Yes.
And as a result of that, they don't look over the wall to see what's out there that might make them better. Fair comment?
They're too invested in what they're doing. The people and the systems, the capital that's invested, they just can't, you know, they're like a monkey that grabs the marbles in the coconut and won't let go, which is how you capture monkeys.
Yeah. So they're protecting the status quo. They're protecting themselves.
Yes. And they try and undermine, they look at new technology, not as something that they can adapt and implement. They look at it as a threat, and they look for ways to, either through government or regulation or who knows what.
So this particular point in time, before we got on here, you were likening it to the period from 1880 to 1920. As far as a change in a whole host of things, political, sociological, economic, et cetera, we're in the same place. Technology's been driving this. I'm going to call it since 1960, just to put a place mark on it. But that rate of change, okay, here comes the iPhone, which is now 15 years old. The rate of change and the advent of artificial intelligence, it's really putting a lot of people at risk, my opinion. Is that, am I looking at it properly?
I think you have to look at it like a petri dish, that the technological change that occurred looks like nothing in the beginning, but it doubles, just like that, you know, story about I'll bet a penny and double it every time, you know, for 18 holes of golf.
Yeah.
And that's what's happened now is it's very difficult for people to understand exponential growth.
Yeah.
And that's what we're faced with. Exponentially, this technology is moving at such a fast pace. And the people that can grab hold of it are going to be fewer because you don't need as many people with the robotics and the AI and everything else. And you're going to find other people that with the labor issues that they're faced with and everything else, they're going to automate. You know, you can program a robot today by just moving its arms and it'll self-improve to do whatever job you want them to do.
Yeah. So how did you transform that to create Winsby?
So what people did was they came to me because I was, you know, had built a lot of companies. And so it was like, would you help, you know, do this? So, and I had built models, financial models to do the buyout business where we could look at something very quickly and determine whether it was worth pursuing. But the problem with financial models is you've got a lot of latitude on minor percentages and you can make almost any numbers jump through hoops. So you can delude yourself. And the reality of owning the company and the reality of running numbers and getting a bank to lend are two different worlds apart.
Right. Big time.
So I got approached to get involved with companies. And then in the process, I started looking at having the time rather than always reacting and to think about, well, what beyond the financial results really drives a business that allows someone to grow. And I'd grown a bunch of companies, like even the Cirrus, operation. We had 2,500 contractors and about 1,500 employees, and we started that from nothing. But the challenge is, what are your drivers, and how do you build and sustain a customer base? And so, I'd seen a paper from a guy from Harvard. I'm trying to think of his name, professor there. That introduced the net promoter score. And he said there was a 79% correlation with a company's ability to grow. So I looked at that and said, well, I wonder if it's tied to anything else. So I ran the numbers against, we had a company that we did this for. So I ran the numbers against retention. And it turned out I could get about a 90% correlation with retention. And that score.
So from the financial model, applying what the Harvard professor had put forward, you could get a 90% correlate, a 90% match.
With their retention rate for the next 4 to 7 months.
And you were able to test that and model it and prove it.
Yes. So then once AI came along, and we do this actually for one of the big communication companies now, where we're monitoring all the calls, and you can identify if someone's giving you a negative comment.
Yeah.
If you add negative comments in, you can get a 96% correlation. And that number is actually higher. So
freeze frame there for a second. Go back to the company that you did this for. What did they think of that mumbo jumbo?
Yeah, it's like, well, so what? It's almost.
Yeah.
And so then it became, and I knew this from before, there's retention, but I couldn't document what the impact of retention was. So for this industry, when we ran the analytics for this industry, every year that you retain a customer, their sales double. So if they bought once the first year and you retained them, it's 2 the second year, 4 the third year. It usually takes 3 to 5 years to bring a customer on. And the customer satisfaction score is really your internal sale of the customers. It's not getting new customers as much as the customer you have and engaging more departments and people to expand your footprint to the extent that you can.
So some come backwards then, go back to Harvard. Harvard did a pretty definitive study on what they called the service profit chain. And they used, I think they had about 200,000 customers, businesses that they looked at and reviewed. And they found in the industrial distribution business, which is the equipment business, the capital goods business, that if you were able to increase customer retention by 5%, so from 80 customers retained to 85, your profitability went up by 45%. Similar, the other side of the coin to what you're talking about.
Yeah, so when we ran that number, Ron, what we found was for every 1% improvement in retention, it translated for most companies to a 12% growth rate annually.
So that's pretty similar.
Yeah. And so that really is your driver. And so it turns out that retention, when you look at the opportunity for this industry, your forecast, the reason why our forecasts are so accurate is that you have everything that you need to grow for the next 3 years in the customer base you currently have.
Yep. And yet, I've worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of dealers around the world, and I haven't walked into one that was able to show me their retention rates for the parts department or the service department or the rental department. But we've got the data, Ron. I said, yeah, but it doesn't do you any good.
Well, they look at it only at one point in time. The other key critical piece to this is that you have to look at it on a rolling basis. And
yes. So
you've got a, let's say you've got a 95% retention rate, which is the average for the equipment industry. That is a 60% rolling 12-month loss rate of customers. You're churning 60% of your customer count on a rolling 12 months. And so the industry is notorious for what's known as, you know, churning and burning. And they end up with less than 20% of their customers. Most of the dealers, when we originally start with them, only have 10 or 15% of their accounts representing 70 to 80% of their profits and revenues.
Yep. And quite frankly, a lot of the, quote, analysts or executives or leaders, whatever, say, well, I only need to look after that 10%, 15% of my customers because that's the majority of my business.
Right.
They leave the rest of it idle.
And I had one salesman tell me one time, I said, you know, how many customers? He goes, we hardly have any customers in this market. And I know them all. I said, well, you've got 80 customers. And our analysis says you've got 1,700 in your market. His response was, I know everybody that matters.
Yeah, right. So it really is, to use a coin, a term, it's a paradigm. They figure they have it figured out, and they're not going to change.
Now, and also people get in a trench. I mean, we did this for one of the big equipment manufacturers looking at one of their divisions. It turned out when we looked at, they had like 60 or 70 dealers. When we looked at their customer bases, every dealer had four or five industries that they were really focused on. But when we took all the dealers, looked at all the companies, it turned out that there are 120 niche markets that were extremely viable, that any four or five of which would support a dealership in their market. So because of the nature of your sales effort, thinking I'm selling equipment versus I'm really servicing a market in terms of parts, service, rental, and equipment, because equipment's only 1% of the transactions for this industry.
That's an important point, because what you're playing with are transactions, correct?
That's transactions from an AI standpoint. Transactions and retention are what drive the business. So revenue is derived. You can't forecast with revenue. You can forecast with customers and transactions.
So why, other than protecting the status quo and being comfortable with how things are done and not wanting to do something that takes them outside of the comfort zone, how do we get dealers? How does Winsby get dealers to change their approach?
I think it's very difficult because the industry is a reactionary industry. You know, they start the day and the first call is always somebody jumping through the phone and needing something. And so you end up having most of the time it's reacting to the demands.
Yeah.
And salesmen too, a lot of salesmen, they look at themselves as account managers because the key accounts are going to be where they sell the equipment. So they're always going for elephant hunting and ignoring the larger part of the market.
So let me take that into a different place. 20 years ago, maybe a bit more, one of the people that I've spoken with called our salesman walking brochures. The salesman was required to take spec sheets to customers because the customer didn't know if he didn't talk to the salesman. Today, recently I wrote about the golden age of information. You want to ask a question, you can get the answer for 99% of what you're looking for. So our customers know just as well as our salesman does everything there is to know about every piece of equipment that they conceivably could purchase. And the customer is saying to our salesman, don't call me, I'll call you. How is the salesman adapted to that market? Or am I misreading the market?
No, you're not. The the risk is that the relationship becomes much more tenuous.
Yeah.
And also the time, because of the efficiencies that, you know, you call them efficiencies, but you think of the amount of time you spend on your cell phone. And
that's pretty scary, actually.
It's very scary. You can look at it. Most cell phones track how many hours you're on the phone. That diversion, sometimes it's constructive, a lot of times it's not, makes it very, very difficult to engage. So the salesman has to be selling the full program. It's no longer a salesman. They sell equipment. The OEM pats them on the back because that's what they want to sell is equipment. But the customer looks at you as parts, service, and rental. Who's going to take care of my real problems? So if you're capable of communicating and handling the parts and service and rental issues, which keep jobs going and delivered on time, you've got a relationship. But a lot of the salesmen kind of are, you know, it varies by dealer, but oftentimes they're white gloves when it comes to anything that's, you know, high priced equipment. But when you really look at the cost and how much money you make on selling equipment, especially in an inflationary environment, you're losing money, even though you think you're reporting money. The only one making money is the IRS collecting taxes on your inflated profits that have no ability to purchase the next piece of equipment.
Yeah. Don Feitz, when he was chairman of Caterpillar, and he's one of, in my opinion, one of the good ones. On his farewell tour, he went around and they always go to each of the dealers and thank them and introduce the new guy. And what Don said to people is, look, the new equipment business is a net zero income business. Get over it. You're going to make money in parts. You're going to make money in labor. You're going to make money in rental. And you're going to make money in financial instruments, not in equipment. And this is a guy whose living was predicated on making money selling machines. People still haven't got it. But so let me say that you're threatening people, because what your implication there is that you're going to have a salesman that's going to sell the house. He's not going to be selling just equipment. And that scares the hell out of every equipment salesman on the planet.
It scares them. It also scares the OEMs, because you're not paying attention to what I want you doing.
Exactly. Exactly.
I gave you this franchise dealership for you to sell my equipment. And you're not selling my equipment. You're selling parts and service. But the better, you know, there are a number of manufacturers that fully understand this and support the parts and services as their primary, you know, avenue for retaining a customer for the opportunity to sell equipment. But that's, again, oftentimes not the case with a lot of the people out there.
It's funny. One of the guys that influenced me seriously early on in my career was Bill Blackie. He was chairman of Caterpillar. He's the guy that created the absorption formula. And I offered to work for him for pretty little money. And he said, you know, that's too much. You've heard this story before. But what Bill said to me and imported on me, which I really not thought about, absorption is not about parts and service making money. It's about controlling expenses as administration interest in sales. He says, don't ever forget that. He said, you can make as much profit as you can conceivably have with 100% market share, and they can spend every penny of it. And they will.
They will.
It's kind of a perverse thing, isn't it? You're right. The manufacturer has the dealer to sell equipment, period. They don't pay any attention to labor. They don't make any money on labor.
Yes. But what's happened from our benchmark surveys show that where brand used to be really critical, brand gets 0 points in Canada. And only 5 points of 100 points on why they do business with the dealer in the United States. It's principally, it's a really important thing to understand.
Oh, hell yes. And the other thing that's happened, but that people don't really talk about, the product differentiation over the last 50 years You line up a bunch of excavators, paint them all white, don't have any decals on them anywhere, and you'd be hard pressed to tell the difference.
And also what's coming out of China, the people, unfortunately, that built plants in China, they trained the first crew. The Chinese moved that crew to a plant that looks better and with enhanced operating procedures. And then they train another crew and they move it to another plant. And I was in Beijing and I'm looking up and I say, God, the one OEM that I was very familiar with, I go, they own this market. And the guy goes, none of those are our cranes.
it's really an interesting world. They've taken continuous improvement or Kaizen, whatever you want to call it, to a religious perspective. In America, we've
lost the ability to manufacture, truly. And it's hard to get someone to go into a plant that's got, that has the hands-on knowledge application requirements that in today's world you need.
So if I own a dealership, the very first thing I should be looking at and concerned about is the machine transactions I had last year. What transactions has that machine generated this year? Should be an important statistic. True?
Yes. The things that really matter are with that machine, the parts, the service, and the warranty claims. Because as a dealer, you can't afford, you think, oh, I make money on warranty, or maybe I don't make money on warranty, but that is not a good thing to have. A warranty claim is an unhappy customer, and it reflects badly on the dealer, and you need to fire OEMs that have real warranty issues, because you'll destroy your market.
Yeah, in fact, we've got examples of that where owners of manufacturers have taken advantage of the profit opportunity and have not reinvested, so that they're, we've got illustrations of that all across the country in all kinds of industries, that where market leaders are, after 10 years, 40 years, 100 years, whatever it is, disappear.
Well, it's like International Harvester. I mean, I was involved with trying to buy Steiger Tractor from them. And the guy who was running it at the time, before they went bankrupt, explained to me that the real business was credit. Mm-hmm. That those farmers were just too dumb to know, if you just give them a deal on finance, they'll buy anything. And Sears Roebuck had the same attitude with the credit. They thought that all the money was being generated by credit. And it was, because they were pushing all their costs up to all the departments. So it made it look like they're generating the money. So a lot of these organizations lose sight of that. What really matters, all business revolves around one event. It's two people exchanging goods and services. That's all it is. And then everything else should be supporting that moment, not the reverse. But a lot of people silo and don't understand that critical relationship.
Yeah. So can you tell me, as part of the services that you provide, I'm an equipment salesman, I have a territory, I have these 100 customers. Can you tell me what the customers that I sold the machine to in 2021 have generated in revenue for me as a dealership in all of what I offer in 2022? Is that part of what you provide?
Yes.
So I imagine almost every dealer that you work with says, well, I've got that information. Is that true?
That's true.
And as a result of that, I don't need you.
They'll say that.
And yet you can't find a report.
Well, they could do it. And the people that do, and I had one in particular a week or two ago said, well, this program, your analytics is taking away a third of my job. I said, what were you doing? He goes, well, I was building a lot of this stuff with Excel files and as needed.
Oh, my.
And And on top of it, I wasn't, you know, in this case, I wasn't able to forecast, and I was usually 60 days behind on providing this. So, you know, everything was out of the barn by the time that anyone figured out what was going on.
Would it be beneficial, Steve, do you think, if your products were available from the business system suppliers, the CDKs and the Emphases and the DISs of the world, or not?
Yeah, I think it, you know, CDK has done a link with our system. So it's really easy to bring on a CDK dealer. You know, John Bowling and that whole team has done a wonderful job in looking for ways to make the information they're gathering usable to the extent they can.
Now, CDK, to my knowledge, has a relationship with Target. You and Target, do you do the same thing or similar things?
Now, Target, those guys, which is invaluable, actually, they can drive down to the detail. So it's great to know that I got a fire burning, but, you know, what specifically, how do you get down to that instant with the information that you would need to determine if you're where the opportunities for cost savings or efficiencies need to, you know, be focused.
So it's the old story about the firefighter, where 95% of their efforts are preventing fires and 5% are fighting fires. And with Target, 95% of the action is showing me where the fires are and 5% is trying to get rid of them. Is that a fair analogy? I don't mean to smack Target, because they do good work.
I think people think they want to know the information. It's important, but you have to know it in the context of, okay, is it going to make a difference? Can I measure the impact? And again, as you know, the allocation of costs, the reason why we avoid getting into how someone, an accountant, decides they're going to allocate based upon whoever's the bigger personality within the organization allocates costs. I tell people that, you know, just straight invoice, it's very difficult to, you know, screw that up, because it's the customer. What are they paying? And then what did you pay for it?
That's pretty clean.
And that way I don't get into arguments with somebody on, well, your numbers are all wrong. They're not. They're actually the real numbers, and you've got accounting problems.
The dilemma I have, Steve, is it comes down to definitions. Cost of sales, like the sale transaction price, that's pretty straightforward and clean. That's what the customer gave me money. I put it in the bank. That's okay. The cost, then, that's where it starts getting a little crazy, because different people put into cost different things.
Yes.
So now I got the Hero Awards, where they all go to AED or the cost of doing business or insight groups or 20 groups. Look at me, I've got this and that and the other thing. The cost of doing business does not have a cost of sales for the service department.
And they don't have a cost of sales because the ability to track true hours and application hours, and what's known as a tar baby machine, everyone's got one, that sits there and magically accrues hundreds of hours. And then someone screwed up on that machine. So if you put a management in of a department, oftentimes they're making it ineffective, because they're applying hours to machines that they shouldn't apply to, or blending hours over into another machine because this one took too long, or, you know, all this, you know, crap that goes on.
Well, it happens all the time. Bill Piles, who I've got a lot of respect for, a service manager in a bunch of different brands and vice president of product support, his last job was with the John Deere side with Nortrax. But he said, you know, confessions of a service manager, repair and maintenance on plant and equipment is high this month. Next month, it's not going to be. It's kind of like squeezing a balloon filled with water. You know, it pops out over here and you get hell. Well, the next month it pops out over there. And, you know, what are we doing? And the fact that the AD can't get a cost of sales for labor is not because they don't want it. It's because the dealers don't have that ability.
They don't have the ability, but they do have, how many techs do they have on payroll? And what's it costing? That's a very simple number.
Very simple.
Very difficult. I'm paying a sales, paying a salesman, I'm paying a tech. I know who they are. I know what they do. I know how much I pay each month, and I know what my contribution is. So if
why,
I'm billing,
so why isn't that something that the dealers are looking at on a monthly basis?
That's what we're doing. We're starting to do that for people.
Okay, good. Good.
That, because we can actually look at payroll and break the payroll up, and you can assign it to a branch in a department. And it doesn't matter how you allocate the hours. What matters is, did you make any money in that department? And then that's why you have a manager. I'm not going to micromanage a service department. I've hired somebody to manage that, manage it profitably. And what he's got is, what are the revenues in, and what is he spending to, service those revenues?
So talk a little bit about, you come in and I own the dealership, and you convince me that I should have you do an initial survey, I'm going to call it that, of my business. And I've got 10 stores and I've got 300 employees and I've got $150 million business. What's it going to cost me to have you do a checkup from the neck up of my business, roughly?
Roughly, if you got 10 locations, probably about $1,000.
So for $1,000, what are you going to show me?
We'll show you what customers are at risk.
Meaning?
Meaning, what's the likelihood that you're going to lose that customer in the next 12 months?
Okay. What else?
It'll show what your retention rates are. By department, by branch.
By salesman as well, or just by
salesman?
Okay. Okay, so let's assume you give that report to somebody and they have 20 salesmen just for grants. And they're varying retentions. Are they surprised at those results?
They should be, but usually what's interesting about salesmen, if they're assigned to an account, a lot of dealers take what are known as house accounts in.
Yep.
And the difference between a salesman owned account versus a house account, the retention rate is almost double.
On the house account or the salesman account?
Salesman account.
Because it gets personal.
Right.
And becomes my income.
It's my income. I own it. And this personal attachment, and we go back to this in the customer. Surprisingly, the customer, even though the sales guy supposedly is only selling equipment, when you ask the customer, who do they contact? They contact the salesman for parts, service, rental, because he's their ombudsman for determining how does that customer get service out of that dealership.
He's the gateway.
And the knowledge and experience of that salesman is really critical. And if that salesman changes, the likelihood of losing that customer is 50% in the next 18 months.
Yeah. And the other thing that's out of the service profit chain as well with Harvard, the other thing that happens if you change the salesman twice in a year, the probability of that customer staying is almost zero.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable. IBM back in the 60s, 70s sold computers, and then they had technical support people, they had software support people, etc. But the boss on the account was the computer salesman. Should the equipment salesman be the boss on the account for the dealership?
Yes.
Okay. Does the data that $1,000 that I spent with you evaluating my business, does it prove that definitively?
Yes.
So how can we get more people to spend $1,000 to test this? What do we need to do?
I think it takes somebody that wants to, it's looking at the business differently. And
yep.
And that is a challenge for almost everybody. I mean, including, I'll put myself in that.
We're all there.
We're always, you know what you know. And then when someone's going, well, take a look at it this way, and you go, well, I don't have time for that. So a lot of this is taking small steps, first understanding, and then choosing one thing at a time. And if you're going to choose one thing, the number one thing is retention. And then retention goes with engagement. So in order to retain them, you need to engage them to get their frequency of purchase up to a high enough level consistently that you'll retain them. It's like going to a restaurant. If you go to a restaurant, you know, once a week for, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, you'll put up with a bad waiter or a bad dessert or, you know, whatever. But if you go once and any of those things go wrong, you're done. And in today's world, because of, you got to remember, your opportunity to lose a customer exponentially increases with every month that goes by.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that used to bother me was the time between the last two transactions. If I can shorten that time gap down, I increase my retention rate dramatically.
Yes.
And I need then to have a tool, I call them triggers. Okay, I haven't had anything from this customer in the last 30 days. And over the last 2.5 years, whatever my time period is, 95% of the time they buy something every 20 days. The buying pattern has changed. I need to do something to find something out.
We give everybody the list of customers they need to contact.
And what are the rules? Do you share those rules with the customer? Is the customer, the dealer, able to influence those rules, or are those trade secrets of Winsford?
The dealer, when you look at who they're contacting, rather than A, B, or C, it's really a stable account is where all your money is, somebody that's never going to leave. In order to get there, you have to get a high enough frequency that's consistent to achieve that. Even a contractor with only 4 machines will buy more than 12 times a year from a dealer, and they prefer 84% of the time to buy from a dealer if it's available. But
if the part or the labor hour is available, correct?
Yes, yes. That's their preference. So all you got to do is make sure it's available. And most of it's parts today. And so monitoring the parts calls and encouraging and also carrying what they buy. You need to have, for the trigger items like filters, good, better, best. You need to be selling 100% of their filter requirements. That'll give you the transactions, because a stable account isn't derived, even though it's 10 times more than your average account, a stable account. Most equipment dealers have 20% of their customers as stable, and it represents, as I said, 70 to 80% of their revenues.
And the dilemma with that, Steve, I think, is that most dealers have come to the conclusion that that's the only part of the market they need to pay attention to.
Right. But they will go out of business in doing that.
That's correct. And we've seen that over the last 20, 30, 40 years with consolidations.
Yeah, they can't survive. You can see it where, as an industry's changing, you're seeing old line, you know, solid, you know, well-established dealerships, you know, blink out of existence and get merged. They're not making it. And it, again, a stable account, even though it's 10 times on average more, but it could be somebody that spent a dollar every other week for a year.
Yeah, it's your penny again. If you double your money every day in a month, you're over $1 million when you start with a penny.
Yes.
And it's, you know, those things are compelling. Like you said earlier today in our discussions, maybe it's on the recording, people have a hard time adjusting to exponential change. And the exponential curve today is damn near vertical. It's gotten more scary as our lives in my 75 years, the rate of change is really ramped up. I might have shared with you, my grandmother was a pretty well-educated person. And when she was about 80, I sat with her and I said, you know, we should sit and record what you've seen in the way of change in your lifetime. She said, Ronnie, you've seen more change in your short lifetime than I've seen in all of mine. And it's true. You don't think about how rapidly things change.
It really is. If you look at a production line, it used to be people would put in a production line. It would have to have to justify a 10 or 15 year life.
Yes. Yeah.
Then it went down to 7 years. Then it went down to 3 years. And they couldn't make it work. So as they shrunk the time to make changes, they became variable machines. So now all you have to do is roll in one machine and you can fix the line and retool. And the speed
at the start, at the head of the line.
Right.
Here comes the machine. We'll redesign the line for that particular machine right now.
Right. And also the CN nature of equipment allows you to, rather than hard programming a machine to stamp something or do something, it's you have the flexibility. You can change whatever you're running through that line. So the flexibility has come at every little step of the way. And all those changes are not linear, or they are exponential.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I keep going back, and you've heard me say this. Ed Gordon says that by 2030, half of the American workforce will not have the job skills required to be employable. And I think you and I both, we might not be 2030, might be 2035, but it's coming soon to a station near you.
Yeah, I think that's the risk right now. And that's why when you brought up the time today is like the 1880s to World War I, where you have a complete disconnect of industrialization and the worker. And, you know, who owns and controls that process? And we're going to have the same problem. You've got automation on one end and technical expertise in the hands of a few controlling a large capability of your economic environment.
What's interesting to me, translate that into the university setting or in the education setting, the professors that are teaching this are invested in the old technology themselves.
Yes.
It's really, really quite interesting. And I know you're heading down this direction. Behavioral science is going to come onto the table, where certain kinds of people, whether it's Briggs-Myers or personalysis or some psychological testing criteria comes into play that says, this person with these skills is best suited for that task. We've never really got there before. That scares the hell out of a lot of people.
Well, it scares people because now you're pre-assigned. Like, you're going to be a farmer. You're going to be it's like you don't have free choice because you've been programmed. And you're going to be a criminal, so we might as well lock you up now and save the world in trouble.
One of our neighbors, when I came out of university, I had a hard time. It was a tough economic time. I had a hard time getting a job. And one of our neighbors was the president of a company, and he had me go to their company and spend 5 days doing all those tests. And it said that I would be a really good farmer. I'm too lazy to be a farmer, Steve. I tell you, that's way too much work. But I think we're getting closer to that day, aren't we, where a problem will show itself through information, through a circumstance, and the person that would be assigned to solve that problem can be identified with specific skills to match that specific problem. It's just like a surgeon. We'll have heart surgeons and we'll have prostate surgeons, and never the two will match. We're going to get there, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's going to be the individual that has the flexibility to absorb information quickly, either because they can mentally or they have tools that provide it, and then apply that knowledge is what's going to kind of take on the changing, rapidly changing world that we're in.
Yeah, one of the things that university are making comments about pretty seriously over the last 10, 20, 30 years is critical thinking is not as plentiful as it used to be.
Yeah, I would say that's true. If people learn things rotely and not see the context, it's like, you know what it is? It's like doing math by formulas and not seeing the picture that the equation creates.
Yeah, we used to tease. My majors were mathematics and physics, and we always used to tease the engineers. You guys deal with our formulas. We tell you what the formula is. You know, you do the arithmetic. We do the neat stuff. You know, but it's true. I've said this for a long time. We're taught to be obedient from a very young age. With our parents is to protect us, to keep us safe. But as we grow older, it's to fit in. So the troublemakers that don't fit in are actually the people I want to pay attention to. They're the ones that say, why do you want to do that? You know, I don't want to do that. Why do you want to do that? We were just recently watching a movie that had Ryan Reynolds in it. And it was one of his early movies. He was a teacher. And a teacher in the same school's father was the teacher of the year for 40 or 50 years in a row, and his father passed away, and the kid decided, well, he's going to take his footsteps or follow in his footsteps. Well, Ryan Reynolds taught in a completely different way, and everybody that was in the room was fascinated. They wanted to learn. The other guy was just teaching it the same old way. And the moral of the story is the guy who gets people thinking, excited, how can we do that? You know, how much time have we got? Well, don't know.
Well, that's really the leadership that's required is someone that can look out and not push people or force them or reward them, but look at a vision and articulate that vision in a way that it's going to be to the benefit of everybody involved. And then with that, you can build a company.
Yep. Somebody asked Eisenhower when he was in London, quote, supreme commander of the Allied troops, what leadership was. And he put a piece of string on the desk. He said to the journalist, he says, push that towards me. And it's a mess. He says, now pull it towards you. It's pretty straightforward. He said, you don't get anywhere by pushing people. And Colin Powell had a different statement. You know, he said, it always amazes me. He said, people will follow me over the hill just out of curiosity to see where I'm going. And my rebuttal to that, or my rejoinder to that, is, well, knowing what his job description was, I don't think I'm going over that hill with him. You know? but you know, Joel Barker says it best in a different way. He said, leaders take people to places that they wouldn't go by themselves because they trust you. And they trust you because you listen to them. You pay attention to them. I don't know that we've got that anymore. We've got a very dogmatic, directing type of leadership rather than encouraging kind of leadership. And I think that's become more prominent over the last 20, 25 years. Corporations have been able to take advantage of this stable, low interest environment, low inflation environment on the backs of employees. Profitability is way up over the last 25 years, and wages are pretty static. That's not going to go for much longer.
No, it's going to change as we speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know people are saying, oh, it's going to go back. People are going to be begging for jobs. But talent in a changing environment gets paid.
No question about it. And working from home, this acronym, WFM, WFH, if you've got a job that you can do remotely and you do not let the employee work remotely, that employee's not going to stay.
No.
It's going to be really interesting. So I've spent $1,000. You've told me what my sustainable business piece is, the 20% of the customers that give me 70, 80%. You've told me what my retention rate is, the number of customers that leave me annually on a rolling 12 basis by department, by store, by sales territory. And I'm going to get that for $1,000.
And also find out, are any of your marketing sales programs working? Generating a return. I mean, some core things that as a someone running a business, you need to know. Otherwise, you're just reacting and you'll just be really surprised if things turn against you.
So what do I need to give you in order to get this?
Need 3 years of invoices.
3 years of invoices.
Yep.
By month or by date? Oh, so I'll have that data on the invoice, won't I?
Yeah.
I'll have price on the invoice.
Yes. You have where it was shipped to, where it was billed to. So we have distance. The AI tracks the distance from your service locations.
Okay, so you're using artificial intelligence to analyze that data. You're running algorithms through it and coming back and telling people statistically, this is what this your business looks like.
Yes, and when we've run this forward, this is always fun. It's done much better than we ever expected. The accuracy of the forecast has been up above 95%.
So let me turn that around a little bit. Could you tell me, okay, for that $1,000, can you tell me what I need to do to be able to achieve those results?
Yes.
So how can we make this more compelling? I'll take a 10% piece of the increase in your business if you'll let me analyze your business and you'll follow my recommendations. Not going to cost you anything, Ron. But I want 10% of what I give you as an opportunity to improve.
Yeah, we'd do that in a heartbeat.
I bet you would. Have you ever tried that?
We haven't. The battle, Ron, comes with when we start doing this. It's who actually did it?
Well, exactly.
I've had salesmen say, that's my customer. And I say, well, they haven't bought from you for 4 years. Are they really out of business and they were your customer? Oh, no, I've been, they're my customer. And you're going, so when change happens, I had one OEM guy, you can appreciate this. He is at a meeting with a whole bunch of executives, and he has the view of the world that nothing gets sold.
The customer buys it.
No, everything that's sold is because of him. And I said, how did you arrive at that conclusion? He said, well, these dealers, they come to me and they want a deal. And the only way it gets done is if I give a discount. That's the only way that this equipment gets sold. So everything's because of me. And, you know, everyone often holds the tail of the elephant, but hopefully not too close to the
to the working end. Okay, so let's wind this down a little bit. Maybe if you could take some time and put together either a single or a series of blogs that explain Wittensby, how, what, pricing, results, etc., that we can put out. Because I believe the success of the dealership is going to be by having good data analytics, having good information, and understanding what to do with that, and having good triggers, and having people that are going to execute on that, and management or leadership that's going to follow up and make sure it happens.
Yeah, a lot of it's very simple things. It doesn't cost money to answer the phone and say yes.
That's right. Yeah. And you'll notice that I wrote a a blog based on that comment that you made to me. Just say yes. I think that's outstanding. You know, we overcomplicate things. You know, the old joke about answer a question with a question, which is something that I used to use years and years ago. You know, just answer. You know, take it. Yeah, I can do that. I can do that.
You can. It's just when and how much.
Yeah. How do you want to close this up, Steve?
What I'll do, Ron, is I'll put together, because this is a lot of information on how this all works.
Yeah.
So just taking one segment at a time. So
okay.
I'll do a blog on just specifically retention.
Perfect.
And then the other key to this is engagement. And internally, you've got to have the data available on a screen in front of whoever is talking to the customer. So how do you get that data to the person who really needs it at that moment? And how do you touch it once? So some of these are tools that are available, and we've built some of them. We've got one of the companies we have is ChatterHub, where every phone call and text and email is tracked and it logs into that account. So a lot of the tools are emerging. So it's like looking at what's going to make this happen with the least amount of, you know, employee input with the greatest impact on, you know, what are they supposed to do? What are they supposed to say? And what information do they really require at that moment, wherever they are in the field or behind a desk or behind the parts counter, to respond to the customer immediately and intelligently? And if they do that, you get transactions, and you also identify, we drop down to the line items when we're looking at what are the trigger items for, which are your drivers,
right,
to get the transactions that you're looking for that will build the business. So it's a lot of information, but I'll put together a series of blogs.
Sounds perfect.
Okay.
Thank you, Steve. And thank everybody for listening to this candid conversation. Hope you've learned something from it. I have, and I urge you to pay attention to what Steve's talking about, because I think the success, the future of your business depends on it. Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We appreciate your support. Should you have any thoughts or comments, please don't hesitate to contact us at www.learningwithoutscars.com. The time is now. Mahalo.